Because I never really understood why church administration, which it came later to be known, was in the religious education school, since the pastor was really the one that was the chief administrator. Why that was not in the pastoral studies.
The religious education course was aimed primarily at the pastor. We had a few, or the students, but very few.
Another thing that you were talking about earlier was the psychology of religion. And I know you had originally done some teaching in the area of psychology of religion, and then Wayne Oates came on the faculty. Was he in the Department of Religious Education at first? I noticed in some of the old catalogs in the 40s, 48 and 49, that they had church administration or church, I guess it was church administration and Sunday school pedagogy and psychology of religion.
Church officials.
Right.
Sunday school pedagogy. And then I inherited, of course, taught by Dr. C.S. Gardner,
right.
Psychology of Religion.
Right, and you just took that out.
It was a book course, and very little of the practical, and that is, it was a study. Dr. Gardner was a sociologist primarily, he was trying to get at the substance of psychology into the curriculum, and had been given a two-hour course in the psychology of religion. And that was academic. Very effective. And it was a fantastic, interesting course to me. I took the course.
And the reason that it didn't go into the School of Religious Education is because you weren't teaching it.
Well, no, I did teach it.
When in the 50s, when Dr. Oates was teaching.
No, that's another story. He was offered the course, and I rather urged him to three others to come into the School of Religious Education. He preferred not to.
I see.
He thought he'd have a broader scope in the School of Theology.
So then primarily he chose which school it would be in. I see. I wanted to know if the Southern Baptists seem to have a concern for evangelism in the Sunday school as a primary thrust. Perhaps even more concern for evangelism than education. Dr. Clements wrote a dissertation on this some few years ago, Bill Clements, in which he worked with Dr. Landry on, and you know Dr. Landry, on the theory that there came a point at which in Sunday school work, one group of Protestants put more emphasis on education, and Baptists and a few other Protestants put more emphasis on evangelism, and they came to a separating of the ways. And I wondered if this was possibly caused by the fact that those who taught in religious education here, Dr. Dement and Dr. Gardner and you and Dr. Edge and probably Dr. Level or Ladder Level were all theologians by training. Was this one of the reasons for moving to evangelism, or was it more that this was what the churches did?
You have to go back to the beginning. There had been nothing done there in the process in evangelism. There were references for Dr. Mullins had in his and his Christian religion and his doctrine of special a section on evangelism, not the theologically oriented. At a meeting of the trustees, sometime in the 30s, Dr. Knight, a trustee, pastor, raised the question as to what was being done in evangelism. And Dr. Mullins had to confess very little. Well, Dr. Sackett at that time, I confessed very little. And he was disturbed from all about it. So a motion was made, I think, by Dr. Knight, that there be introduced a course in evangelism. It was carried and brought to the faculty. And several of them shook their heads. And I, being one of the youngest of members of the faculty, it fell to my lot. That's how I came to be in the, it was, of course, my interest had been along that line. I'd had some work in the field of church administration and evangelism, primarily back there, and much even now, evangelism was equated with the revival, how to conduct a revival. It was that point that I took it up. I began to realize that we were reaching a point, even then, on the 40s, where the revival began to be more or less not productive, and had been during the Great Awakening. I traced the history briefly of the revival, and then the emphasis began to be put in the Sunday school literature and in the field work of the Sunday school board on the Sunday school as the agent of the church in evangelism. That appealed to me. I certainly didn't discount the revival and put me out of myself. But I saw very clearly that there was too much superficiality in the dependence on a revival once a year. Dr. Mullins referred to it as the children fever type of evangelism. A long chill followed by a fever. And he and I talked about it and elaborated. And out of that came my Evangelism According to Christ, which was perhaps my most popular, most widely circulated. And that came, of course, out of my experience teaching the course and the development of the idea that, though, to be specific, that the fourth gospel probably represented the Apostle John, the writer's experience as pastor of Ephesus in winning people to Christ. As you know, of course, it's not one of the synoptics. It does not undertake to be a history of the historic Jesus, or the Christ of faith. And in the concluding chapter, next concluding chapter, he says, these things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and believing have life in his name. Well, believe what? And you turn to the first chapter, and they call it the prologue. I think it was John's first sermon in the revival. Or in his pastoral experience, his preaching. What is evangelism? It's getting people to believe in the claims of Jesus. What are those claims? And then, with inspired insight, John begins to illustrate it with Nicodemus. How did Jesus deal with Nicodemus? And then at the top of the ladder, now at the bottom of the social ladder, was the Samaritan woman. Now you follow that on through, and you find that John is here illustrating how Jesus did it. How he met objections, how he met criticism, how he implemented this thesis that to become a Christian, you believe in the claims of Jesus, you accept the claims of Jesus, his lordship. It then carries you on through to the crucifixion and the resurrection. And that then became my plan of holding a revival.
Not bad plan.
It sure isn't. I got that across here in this group. That was one of my best attended courses I'd have sometimes rather than 50 out of 10 5 years left.
Dr. Dobbins, you've mentioned Emerson's book and some of its influence on what you put into your courses. What are some other things that influenced what you decided to do in your courses? Were there people that influenced this or ideas? Did people directly tell you what to do, or did you make the decisions yourself? How did this go?
Well, it came out of experience. And I came to the seminary, tried to introduce this course. It wasn't looked on as being on the seminary level. It wasn't scholarly, but the only problem was the body of divinity. And I had to recognize that and try to make it so. A year before I came, Fenley Gibson came to the pastor of Walter Street. Walter Street had the history of the record of being pulpit center. Had some of the great pulpiteers as pastors. But by 1920, that area began to change. It had been the residential area of the elite. Now it began to change. Suburbs developed. Best time was low down. And the last pastor they had gave up. Lindbergh, I believe, was the manager of that. He was a tremendous preacher. Made almost no interest at all from the Sunday school or on pastoral care. He preached to a diminishing congregation. And they called Fenley Gibson because he at Richmond, Virginia, had majored on evangelism. And evangelism by way of the Sunday school. He came, had a little Sunday school about 350, very inadequate facilities. He was not a tremendous preacher, good preacher, but the gospel preacher. But he came with a view changing the course of that church from a pulpit center to an evangelistic center church. He was a disciple of Arthur Flake, fitting a standard Sunday school that had just come up. And of course I was using that book also. So he and I collaborated. And Walnut Street became my laboratory in about the third year of my teaching. I even had the classes go down to the church. Uh-huh. And we took the first census. I suppose it was taken in the state. Yeah. And I never heard of a Sunday school census. And we had to do it for Sub Rosa, as well as those who wouldn't think for it. But to the class forming the back. And I was a member of the census group and some devoted members. We went then, made the communities all by blocks, carried through Wake Lakes to plan, discover the prospects. We got through and tabulated the returns. There were approximately 2,700 prospects that we discovered within that total area. Well, there was another competing Baptist church. People who didn't belong to any Sunday school. Of course, we didn't have any idea at all that 2,700 of them were real prospects, but they were those who we covered back in those days as prospects. They were going to our area. So, the next step then was to provide facilities for them. And the big auditorium was in our hands without a balcony. Didn't finish the balcony, but regularly. And they had one big room for all the children from infancy up to 12 years.
They had a pretty good laboratory, didn't they?
Yes. They had a baraka class for the men, a Philadelphia class for the women, a young people's class for the girls and the boys, and an intermediate class. And juniors, and the rest of them were in the big room. So that was a right field for exploration, experimentation, and proving that Blake scheme could work. And that was interesting. Of course, then we began to figure out again those people that live in a building, an education building. No way to make the old street check and nothing but a part of a basement and some roads in the rear. But upstairs, there's no possibility of carrying for more than about 350, 400 possibly. So without consulting anybody, we just got an architect on base to draw some plans for an education building, a graded building. We took that to the deacons. And one man, I found his name, a dentist, got up and he raised the no, we said, we're not going to this. There's always been a preaching church. All these people were invited. He said, you bring the riff-raff of this community into our good church if you haven't got all these people. Anyhow, and we've got all the our own children, and we send our children there. We know they're going to associate with that kind of people. Well, I didn't say anything. I watched Gibson, he didn't say anything. Until the others chimed in, bearing down the whole idea. Gibson got up, put on his overcoat, got back this time of year. And walked out. And worked. There was silence. I didn't say anything. I was just there backing up the picture, offering our services to someone. We sat there in silence, and the young deacon, gentleman and others, got up and said that we called this man to do a different. Yeah, you know we're not preaching to people. And the man who just preached. And he told us this sort of thing he was doing in Richmond. And he said, we want you to come to the ambulance. Now, it isn't a question of a person. He's all right. He's John, he's cool with him. It's a question of policy. If we don't support him, he's going to leave us. No question about that. We'll go right back to our before. I want to make a motion. I move, first of all, that the doctor, who has been opposed to this, he has to refute himself. What do you got? Yes. And I said, I want to make a motion that we request the doctor and anybody who supports him to resign from the Board of Deacons. And it passed. Almost unanimously. The doctor came back. He was told, Dr. Patton, you can't do that to me. We've already done it. And he said, what will my wife say? What will my people think? What will my clients say? You just can't do it. We'll give you 30 days to change your mind. But we're going to keep this man. And follow more or less these ideas. We're going to build this building. Well, we sat down a little while for this list. Before the 3 days were over, he had come completely around and had a description list for the building. And so we built the first education building, as far as I know, in Lowell.
At Walnut
Street. And within 3 years, we had occupied it, overrun it, and I saw the enrollment climb to about 1,000. Now, I don't know whether you want any of that in your thesis or not, but
it's a good story.
It's a good story.
It's true, yeah.
Now, what was I getting at?
I was asking what outside influences had influenced what you put in your courses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, part
that's,
of this
that
is
story.
Today.
That story went on. I then developed a field work program. I had some selected pastors come over to Lowe's Hall and we had our mess over there for a meal. And I presented to them the idea of having these students come as interns, so to speak, as observers, to make surveys to study the situation. They wouldn't get in the way, they asked to teach or anything, but just to go for maybe 6 weeks or 3 months. And I have to study how not to study, what they're doing with criteria, or with the Jewish synagogue, and so on. And the student took to that. It was an innovation. They'd never had anything like that before. And they liked being in these other churches. And the preachers approved it. And they gave time to it. They agreed. I said, now you've got to agree that you're going to help these students, not just let them come in and muddle through. But you give them time to sit in the office with you and talk about what you're doing, how you're doing it, what your plans are, what your goals are, and write a survey paper on it. Well, that, I think, was a revolutionary thing in theological education, a vocational training. I have no apology for it. I remember one faculty meeting, one of our leading professors gave his sort of time to do and said, now, I just am against this, what this young professor is doing. And what they're doing is all right, I suppose, if it were a Bible school, but this theological seminary, these men will have 3 years in which to get their Greek, their Hebrew, the Old New Testament, and theology, the rest of their lives to do this sort of thing. And he's taking too much time, but the student. And I didn't take the time. I told them why they wanted to do it. Most of them, some of them groaned over the bit, but most of them had just felt to know it was what they needed. But Dr. Mullen stood right up for me. No, we didn't have good school. It's only called this man for churches wasn't needed, the men needed. And he's not going to take. Back in those days, from Aztec, many of a period of time working on Greek or Hebrew exegesis, 6 or 8 hours at a time. I just didn't get enough out of it to justify that much concentration. And you had to take all of Hebrew and all of Greek.
My father's telling me about that. It brings up another question. Of course, in the 20s and 30s and even in the 40s, all of the men who were here were studying for the ministry. And you began the idea, really, of a man coming to the seminary who was interested in the field of education and working in the church, and these were primarily laymen to begin with. What requirements or what did the seminary do about admitting laymen?
Well, there were two things that could be done. One was to admit him as an auditor.
Auditor?
Mm-hmm. Without meeting the requirements or having a degree. They could very well refuse that. From the other one, then take this for anybody else takes. I was the beginning. The nearest to being a minister of education was to be a paid superintendent.
Okay.
That began to develop. My church in Hattiesburg employed a man who had come to the seminary. His health had failed. His home was there in Hattiesburg. And he'd been very active. Bit nervous breakdown and so couldn't undertake any responsibility. And the church paid him, I think, $50 a month to be the paid superintendent. And that was the nearest thing that we had. But that began to catch on. And other churches would send that superintendent, maybe, to the seminary. They could just follow a brief course and say, give him a while, get what he could, and do the auditory type thing. And then I began to develop this idea of a trained man, fully equipped, to supervise the total program of education of the church. That came along in the late 1950s. I think there was some statistical recognition of the community. Many of them took the full course.
There was a degree called the Bachelor of Divinity in Religious Education. Did this degree arise as a result of the desire of the churches to have a trained man in the area?
We had a bachelor in what did they call it? Where the student did everything except, I believe, the languages. Mm-hmm. It's a non-language degree. And what did they call that? They think that was the PD, and that's from the Divinity. And
they had a BDRE.
Bachelor of Theology, and Master of Theology, and Doctor of Theology. Then this bachelor degree was offered. I'm not sure whether it's 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. 2 years, I believe. It was more a diploma type of course. Mm-hmm. You got a diploma to get your degree. Mm-hmm.
Did that kind of lead into the forming of the School of Religious Education?
Because I now began to be a trend, due in part, I suppose, to the advances in this field made by Southwestern. Mm-hmm. They had now, by now, a school of religious education.
Were they getting the majority of the students who wanted to do that?
Yes.
Did this influence what Southern did?
I think so, indirectly. We would like to admit that Southwestern influenced.
That also brings up another question. Dr. Ibe suggested that there were some conscious decisions made about the School of Religious Education here that made it different than the school in Fort Worth. Do you remember what any of these conscious decisions were? For instance, he suggested that the idea of the School of Religious Education being in the same building as the School of Theology, rather than a separate building as it was at Fort Worth. Do you remember any of the other kind of decisions like that?
Dr. Ennis Fuller became our president. He's been a great pastor. He did not have a doctorate degree. He had taken some graduate study. And he had the experience, that first church at Napa, of utilizing his Sunday school as one of his primary outreach agents. I think largely the School of Education, as an entity, grew out of his concept. His desire to see these courses in religious education made into a school. How far he was going by Southwestern, I don't know, maybe to some extent. I don't think that was primary. He had been a long time pastor. First Church of Atlanta was one of our great churches. He came here not being a scholar, not having an earned doctor's degree, from being a passionate evangelistic preacher. And there was some talk. I remember Dale Moody talking to me about it. He said, now, why did you do this thing? Did you get some property over here across the street and have a school of your own? And of course, you'd have to in it this year, you can see how they're in the thing you don't do, and maybe take some courses. But that's the way they do it sometimes. I'll read it.